weren't exact, and I think you covered it. Very good. Really was a little bit of a mystery. Because you went 40 hertz, roughly, between the series mode and the parallel mode at 1 megahertz, and if I divide 40 hertz into 1 megahertz, I think that says that your Q, let me think now, if it was 10 hertz, it would be 100 thou. Yeah. I think you've got 25,000. You just confirmed that your particular crystal has an approximate measured Q of 25,000. The delta frequency between those two modes divided into the center frequency is a rough approximation of the Q, and your Q is in the vicinity of 25,000. Not the highest in the world, but darn good. And that being used to control the frequency of an oscillator can do a very good job. I think one of the crystals you've got, if I understand correctly, John, came out of a reference oscillator system that has a oven in it, because they really want precise frequencies, and I wonder if that's the particular crystal you tested in this particular experiment. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. No, Dick, this crystal is very similar to the old CE-type crystals, the little 1-inch by 1-inch by quarter-inch case with two pins on the bottom. The one you're speaking about is out of a counter, and that, I have not run the experiment on that, but I assume that that is going to have a much higher Q, I would imagine, but I haven't made that test yet. That'll be interesting. Now you see why radio engineers for so many years really fell in love with quartz crystal resonators. And at 1 megacycle or 10 megacycles, they can make some very high performance reference oscillators for frequency counters and frequency synthesizers and vector network analyzers, spectrum analyzers, and so on. So very few things have got better frequency stability than quartz. Cesium beam and rubidium are better, but they've got other characteristics that are hard to live with. The highest Q oscillator anybody knows of for most of the last 40 years has been cesium. That is to say, it's got a very, very low aging rate. That's the good news. But the amount of instantaneous FM noise you get out of cesium beam is less than desirable. So if you really want the world's best frequency synthesizer, you use cesium beam to determine the exact center frequency. That, in turn, is used to stabilize a rubidium crystal. That, in turn, is used to discipline, as they say, a quartz crystal. There are some oscillating assemblies you can buy where the spectral purity, in other words, how sharp a single line you get on an ideal spectrum analyzer out of the reference oscillator, you can get an extremely clean-looking line when you use combinations of oscillators like I just described. And there's a lot of work. Let me drop. There's a lot of work that has gone on over the last 20, 30 years on something called spectral purity. Every one of us can make a voltage-controlled oscillator. We take an inductor and capacitor, put them across each other, making it into a transistor. You make it into a free-running oscillator. And you take that free-running oscillator and you put it onto a spectrum analyzer, and you'll see something that looks like a haystack. It's a Gaussian-shaped curve, because most of the time the oscillator is at that center frequency at the peak, but occasionally it jitters in frequency or phase and gives you this other, a little bit of energy at slightly higher and lower frequencies. That's why it generates that Gaussian-shaped curve. You get one of these very high spectral purity oscillators. You put it into an ideal spectrum analyzer, and you get a simple, straight, vertical line in the middle of the screen and nothing else. That's the good news. And seeking that has a lot of merit. If you're building a state-of-the-art, modern-day airborne radar, and if you can get oscillators of that kind of stability, or even if it's a ground-based radar, or if it's a surveillance receiver, surveillance reconnaissance receiver, let me drop a quick. If you build a high enough quality surveillance reconnaissance receiver where you're monitoring somebody else's radar, and if the oscillators in your receiver have high enough spectral purity that you really measure the residual FM, the undesired modulations of that radar signal that's being transmitted. And you do a careful enough measurement of the spectral purity, so to speak, of the radar pulses. You then come up with a signature by which you know when they change the tube in the radar, because you see one signature today, and tomorrow you see a different signature, and you say, hey, they just changed the tube. I wonder if they transported that radar and hit a bump and damaged something, and they made a change. Or you look at the particular signature of that radar, and today it was in this city, and tomorrow it's in that city. And you know that because you're making these fine measurements of the residual modulations, the undesired characteristics. And if you build high enough stability oscillators, you can resolve those kind of things. And I've seen people who do that kind of work. Magic stuff. So the word radar is a very relative word. When it comes to making measurements of somebody else's radar, boy, there are measurements and there are measurements. You'd be amazed how many characteristics there are on a radio signal once it has been radiated, or even before it's been radiated. Fun type stuff. And that's an art and a science of itself. Anybody have any further questions or comments on what you've heard so far, give me a call at us right now, K2LAW and the Tech Man. Okay, according to our schedule, and gee, we're on schedule a lot better than normal tonight. At around 9 o'clock, we go over to the mailbag. And I'll bet you've got some fancy questions from these scientists out there that are in the process of getting their ham license. Go right ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW and the Tech Man.
And Y2H with a quick comment.
Okay, stand by a minute, John. Go ahead, Lou. And Lou, once again, I'm very glad that you issued that letter on the subject of the discussion, the relatively heated discussion going on among LIMOC members over the last couple of weeks. Lou did some research, found some good references, sent us all an email, and from my point of view, the email says something very positive. Unfortunately, there's more than one interpretation I'm hearing about from that email, even though you put it into very clear words, Lou. NY2H, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
C2IS, I'm in.
Stand by, Bill. Lou is next. NY2H, go ahead.
Yeah, he did very fine, yeah. And I think one of the things mentioned in that piece is that you can't bring the resistance back to 50 ohms either by doing that. So, I'm not sure. Anyway, I just want to remind the folks that we have this chat room going on. We had about four people in there a little while ago. And the web address is UR, as in Uniform Romeo, webchat.com/technet. UR, webchat.com/technet. NY2H.
Now, I claim to be an RF person, but when it comes to computers and internet, I'm at best an appliance operator and a neophyte. So give us a couple of words, Lou. The chat room of the TechNet, here we go, the TechNet chat room. The people who sign in, are they giving messages back and forth to each other that, hey, why doesn't that guy speed up or slow down, or, gee, I wish he would ask so-and-so? Tell us a little bit about the motive of the people who sign into the chat room, the kind of information that's being transferred, and why it's good and why more people should be using it. Give us a few words on that, Lou, because I've never used a chat room. I've never used social networking. I'm a real dinosaur, so you've got to bring me up to speed. NY2H, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, Lou, also tell us if the chat room is active after the TechNet into it.
I'm going to repeat what Larry said. What Barry said. A little bit noisy there, Barry, as you move with your vehicle. So he wants to know: does the chat room proceed after the TechNet? And so tell us everything we want to know, and we're afraid to ask Lou about the chat room. NY2H, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
All right. Last week we had two folks from Canada in, and one of them had requested that we put this chat room together. I don't know if it was V3JIW, Jim, he was in tonight. Barry, it's 24/7, actually. So, yeah, it'll go on. So it's on all the time. And basically, as per his request, we put this together and left some comments going along with the TechNet text, if you will. Nothing startling, but I can envision maybe a parallel thread going on here with comments concerning the topic of interest at the moment. So it's a resource, and anybody can log in. You don't have to be a ham to log in. If you do log in and you're not a ham, just log in with your name. If you are, give us your call, dash your name, and join the discussions. NY2H.
Boy, have you given me an idea, Halu. I'm going to ask you a crazy question. Again, I'm a neophyte, so be careful. should we assign a human being to monitor the chat room as a source of questions? In other words, there's a guy out there who uses his scanning receiver. He happened to scan across 146.85 one Sunday evening. He found a bunch of guys having a grand old time and enjoying themselves on something called a TechNet. Some of the people enjoying themselves. Some of them getting a little bit angry. Anyhow, he discovered that something good is happening. He wants to join it. Doesn't yet have his ham license. He gets onto the chat room and he starts posing questions. For some reason, it's a question he'd like to have answered immediately. He didn't get a chance to send a snail mail or an email to John yet, KC2WGB. And so, should we assign a person to monitor the chat room as a way of finding an additional question that's being asked, a hot question, so that we bring it to the net for a guy who doesn't yet have his ham license? That's a crazy question, and maybe we shouldn't spend the resources. Maybe we should. I mean, look at all of the ways that you get, for instance, Rich, K2UPS, with his tractor trailer truck driving across the Midwest by various electronic connection means, but by cell phone, Echo Link, and by IRLP. While he's driving, he's listening and sometimes signing in with questions. Let me drop. So in theory, you got people with in many countries of the world, in many locations. They have ways of electronically and internet-wise and RF-wise getting into this thing, joining the question, giving us the benefit of their experience in various areas of radio and science and so on. So here's another thing called chat room. So what do you think along those lines, Lou? Am I going a little too far? I can't volunteer to do that because I'm more than busy enough as it is. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's precisely, you're right on target. This is fashioned after Ham Nation. That's the podcast. I think it's on live Wednesday nights, and you can review it at any time after that with Bob Heil of the microphone fame and Gordon West and George Thomas put together this podcast. And they have a gal on there who monitors the chat room and will occasionally interject what's going on in the chat room, pose some questions that were asked on the chat room, so on and so forth. In fact, right now, Eric, KC2WRE, just posted, the value of the chat room is being able to offer commentary on matters under discussion without becoming engaged in a protracted debate. Additionally, one can provide fact checks when necessary. So there you go. Last week, someone actually posted a link, and it came up on the right panel, the website itself. I think it was to the website that you talk about where your article's posted. Let me let it drop. And, yeah, and Jim is reminding me it's Cheryl at Ham Nation who monitors the chat. So that's, maybe John, I don't know if he's overwhelmed with a mail, et cetera, but if not, he could certainly monitor this too. I'd volunteer, except they may not be available every Sunday night, but anybody can do it. Anybody who logs in can get back to the net and serve as a bridge. NY2H.
One more time, where is the chat room, please?
Give that again, Luke.
missed a couple of the phonetics. It's www.urchat.com/technet.
It's actually urwebchat.com/technet. www. You know, if you read it outright, it would be urwebchat.com/technet, but it's not U-R-Y-O-U-R. It's get rid of the Y-O. It's just U-R. So it's www.urwebchat.com/technet.
And unfortunately, that URL gives me a 404 error.
Make sure you have the www in there. Try to make it a forward slash. Technet is T-E-C-H-N-E-T, one word.
I have www.urwebchat.com/tech.net. That's the problem.
Yeah, no dot there.
And there have been other people who
have
trouble.
Thank you, KB2IQN.
Oh, KB2IQN. Very, very glad to hear from you, Chris. Chris is my harmonic, who is right now 70 miles away. My goodness, are we connected. Internet. And Chris, give us a couple of words as to the complicated way, because you and I use Debian Linux-based hardware as far as our computing is concerned. And ordinarily, some of these connection techniques are very Microsoft-based. You and I are non-Microsoft people. You had to do some very fancy things in order to be able to make the connection. Give us a couple of words about that, because I can't even remember the vocabulary of it, Chris. KB2IQN, an internet-like connection, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, it's I'm connecting by way of Qtel, which is Qt Echolink, which is a client for Linux. Hardware is not related. This is a web browser based chat room for that's being discussed. I haven't logged in yet, so I've just gotten to the page to log in.
Yeah, what I was asking though is the method by which you are talking to us right now. I think you had to do some adaptation to networking systems in order to be able to make the connection that you just made. Maybe I'm wrong. Over to you for a couple of words on that, Chris. KB2IQN, K2LIW.
All right, well, I'll mention this. The problem that I had is that there's no Echolink client directly for Linux. That Echolink, the word Echolink is Windows only. To get Echolink to work, you have to have a Windows system, and you have to do port forwarding on the firewall to have two particular ports go through the firewall to your computer. What I did was I actually found an upstream project called SVXLink. That's Sierra Victor X-Ray Lima India November Kilo. Boy, that took me a while. All right, so SVXLink is something you can compile for Linux, and that contains a client called Qtel, which is Qt Echolink. And I had to build that into a Debian package myself because one didn't exist, or I found someone's base project, but the package that I put together is in a poor state where I'm trying to separate Qtel from SVXLink and remote TRX. There's like server packages and client packages in this package along with libraries, and in order to separate them, it becomes a situation where you have to ship libraries. So anyway, it's a Debian packaging situation when it comes to SVXLink that I had trouble with. Nothing to do with networking per se. Back to you.
As you can tell, I can't remember any of that vocabulary. I couldn't repeat any of that back to you. I'm such a non-computer person. I knew it was complicated. I guarantee there are other people out there, Chris, who are using Linux-like, Debian-like, Red Hat-like systems who want to get into Echolink. You are in the process of solving a problem that's not completely unique as I see it. That's the reason I wanted to give a couple of words on it. And sounds to me like in the future you probably will have a relatively clean method of doing that. And at the rate you're going, I suspect there are other people who are going to really value what you've just done. I'm going to send it back to you, Chris, for any further words on that. KB2IQN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KB2IQN. Probably what I'll end up doing is building SVX Link into one bundled package that'll make things a lot simpler than having to ship separate library packages. And then I'll be uploading that to a private repository to begin with. And I'm on the Debian Hams mailing list, where there are some Debian developers that actually ship packages. They have basically it's a ham-related team for shipping Debian packages, so I can have it uploaded to Debian that way. That's at least a long-term plan. I've got lots of other issues to deal with your computer and other things other things that keep interrupting that. Back to net, KB2IQN.
K2AP with a comment.
K2AP, start off with your name first.
Thanks, Vic. The name is Joe, Juliet Oscar Echo, QO2 Alpha Papa. Can I make my comment?
We're waiting, Joe. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I know it's kind of a roundabout way, but the way I use Echo Link, I'm using Ubuntu. And the way I used Echo Link was with the Wine package, which is officially called not a Windows emulator, but what it does is it allows Windows programs to be able to run. So, I mean, it's not the ideal way to work, but it does run Echo Link that way. So it's just a comment. Okay, so I'll be back to that.
Let me address that, please.
That's exactly what I wanted you to do. Go right ahead then, Chris.
Okay. Wine is not an option, and here's why. Wine stands for, is not an emulator, just like you said. However, on Debian, Wine is not installable on the AMD64 version of Debian, meaning that if you're running a modern 64-bit operating system, Wine is not installable. In order to install Wine, you have to do what's called multi-arch, which you have to install a secondary architecture on your AMD64 system for i386. And then when you install Wine, it's for i386 only. And so you're trying to emulate Echo Link in 32-bit Windows on a 32-bit package for Wine and on an AMD64 system. And that creates other problems when it comes to upgrades, because the Debian system, when they try to upgrade, when you've got multi-architecture system, gets more confused. So I'm trying to avoid that, and that's why I went to Qtel, which is native AMD64 or i386 or other architectures. For instance, Debian runs on Spark or Itanium or ARM or other systems, and Qtel may very well work for those where Echo Link will not, because Echo Link is Windows only. Back to net, KB2IQN.
Thank you, Chris. I'm going to have some fun here. John, KC2WGB, did you get all that? All right, go ahead, John.
Anytime you're ready, Mr. DeMills. No.
The original quote was, ready when you are, CB. Supposedly, Cecil B. DeMille created a great big town called Atlanta, Georgia, in mock-up, and it burned down as part of the design of one of the scenes in Gone with the Wind. And all the fire was set off, the town was burned down, and Cecil B. DeMille talked to his main cameraman saying, did you get all that? And the cameraman says, ready when you are, CB. In other words, the cameras were not rolling yet, and $500,000 worth of hardware just got burned down. there are computing systems, newer computing systems. I had a very old-fashioned machine in my house. Let me drop. And Chris has just equipped me a week ago with the latest and the greatest. And it's a screamer of a machine. It can do all kinds of things. And it's in some functions that I want to do, it's 100 times faster, and I'm not kidding. That's the good news. The bad news now is I get myself in trouble 100 times faster. I pressed some combination of keys that did something that made all the control panels on the screen disappear, and we're going to have to slowly get that back. So as I see it, anybody can make a mistake. To really screw up requires a modern-day fast screaming computer. Alrighty. Any further questions or comments and all the above? After that, I'm going to turn it over briefly to Bill, AC2IS. But anybody with any comments on what we just heard, give me a call. That is the name right now, K2LAW, to be in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is Joe, K2AP again.
Go right ahead, Joe. And your signal is a little bit noisy, but we're hearing you very well. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, yeah, I can raise the power, but if you're hearing me, okay, yeah, I'm on about 40 watts, I guess. My comment is, yeah, I agree with you 100%, but my take on that is I've been using Linux in 32-bit whenever I possibly can, because for some strange reason, almost anything I try to do, I have a lot of problems with 64. For example, at least in my experience, I've never been able to get Telnet server to work in 64-bit. So whenever I can, I install the 32-bit. And with the 32-bit, which is what I have here, it works heckling fine. But I can appreciate what you're saying, and that makes a lot of sense. So I just wanted to add my 2 cents to it. K2AP back to this.
After a delay, Chris, go ahead and put some words on that.
Okay. Well, basically, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with running 32-bit, except that when running 32-bit, you end up having programs that have a limitation of using only up to 3 gigabytes of RAM because of limitation of 32-bit access for RAM. The kernel can be 64-bit even on a 32-bit system. That's another complication. So if you do that, the kernel can use all the RAM that's in the system. Oh, excuse me. Sorry, I just wanted to make sure that music stopped. Phone call. Anyway, so the reason I run AMD 64 is I've got more RAM in most of these systems. Like my father's system that I just put together, that's got a lot more RAM than a 32-bit system could normally use, and so I want the programs to be able to access as much of the RAM as possible. So that's the reason for running 64-bit. That's basically the only reason, other than getting around the Unix clock problem that's eventually going to come in, I think, 2038 or something like that. But that's pretty far off. Back to net.
Very fine, Chris. What Chris had to do is to turn off his cell phone because there's a particular person that calls him. His cell phone responds by playing one of the classic pieces of music out of Star Trek, one of the particular good scenes out of Star Trek, and he didn't want that to go over the air. It's fun stuff. These computers, I don't know. The combination of adding a microprocessor in computers and RF hardware, and that's a flash in the pan. It's never going to catch on. Cell phones, that's never going to go anywhere. Obviously, it's a great big ironic statement of mine. John, tell us what you found in the mailbag. Let's get our feet back on the ground here, John. KC2 WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Dick, didn't you want to pick up Bill, I believe?
You're absolutely right. Sorry about that. Bill, AC2IS, K2LAW. Go ahead with your comment, Bill.
AC2IS here, thanks, Dick. I was just reading something earlier today on transmitting, which sounds a lot like what you were talking about with radar. Sort of that, and the idea is to be able to identify different ham radios, identify the actual hardware system, which is broken.
Bill, I'm looking forward to the day when you put that antenna on the top of the roof of your house. I'm pretty sure I heard what you said, but your signal was 80% noise, 20% audio throughout most of that last transmission. But what I think you were saying is that you read some articles where some of the modern equipment measuring residual modulations and things like this is able to identify individual ham radio transmitters. And so spectral signature of radio signals is a real art and science. It's been around for a while. I worked for 30 years for a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory. Arguably Presumably they did some of the pioneering work on that, starting in the late 60s, early 70s. Turns out that it now can be revealed that the main receiver that was on the SR-71 aircraft was a product of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and some of the really genius equipment that was put on there by Matt Bourque was one of the mathematical geniuses, among others, who devised these various techniques by which you do careful spectral signature of the signals you're receiving that were coming into the SR-71 as it flew over very vital places around the world. They were able to tell when somebody changed the tube on the radar, when the radar moved from one location to another overnight, all kinds of fancy pieces of information, and a lot more that I'm not going to mention was coming out of that. So the word radio and the word radar and the word surveillance and reconnaissance receiver, very relative words, that when you dig into the nitty-gritty of what those things are capable of doing, if you're smart enough mathematically, electronically, and whatever, it's kind of amazing, and a lot of people were really... Let me drop. A lot of people were very amazed by those capabilities, and as such, additional contracts were issued in order to further that work, because it was so effective, it was so... It produced such very good, very useful data during those periods of time, the so-called Cold War. We now look back on it with humor that awful lot of what we were worried about was not worth worrying about. But you didn't know. You didn't know, so to speak. And as such, lots of people were shaking in their boots saying, how many submarines and how many bombers and how many ICBMs do they have? And are they directed at us, and what do we have to defend ourselves, and so on. And because I was working on the B-1B bomber at the time, one of these fairly serious pieces of military hardware, which has got capability that can scare the hell out of you. And I'm a dove working on a very hawkish program for quite a number of years, and I justified that by saying that if you carry a big enough club and you scare somebody with it, you never have to use it. That was the only way I could justify my minor involvement, if you know what I mean. Interesting stuff, and there's a lot more to the story, as you can tell. Okay, I think I captured some of the essence of what you said, Bill. Let me turn it over to you to be sure. AC2IS, and maybe Chris and I should go over there. You helped us install something in my backyard once. Maybe Chris and I should go over there and help you install an antenna on your house. AC2IS, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. The idea was a particular project that was working with a PC and a sound card that can control the system requirements. AC2IS.
Yeah, I could tell you were talking, Bill. But the propagation goes up and down, and your signal was so noisy that time. If it's a handy talkie you're using, maybe it's got to be put in a better position, and it's going to take some experimenting. One of the things that people keep rediscovering, if you're, for instance, using a handy talkie, and you're in a fairly weak signal area for a particular repeater, common sense would lead you to believe you walk around the room, you know, there are peaks and valleys, and you stop at the spot where you're getting a good reception, and then you try to answer the person. You transmit back to the repeater from that spot. Well, Mother Nature's got a couple of surprises for you. Because of the 600 kc of difference between transmit and receive frequency, that little bit of difference in wavelength, and the 1,000 wavelengths you've got between you and that repeater, that when you're in the best spot where you get the best reception, it is not, in general, the best spot for transmitting. So there's one magic spot in your room for the best spot for receiving with your handy-talkie, and there's another spot to hold the handy-talkie to be the best spot for transmitting back to that repeater. And lots of people keep rediscovering that. John, KC2WGB, wow is with what's in that mailbag. You got it, John. K2LAW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Alrighty. We've got a young man here. His name is Jeff. And he has a question on bar magnets, or magnets in general. The question is, if he has two magnets, and he makes an interference field with them, and these magnets are slowly oscillating, does that create a harmonic magnetic wave? That's basically his question, Dick.
almost positive the answer is no. But when you say the magnetic oscillation, is he spinning one of those bar magnets? Is one of those magnets an electromagnetic magnet where he can change the voltage and therefore to change the magnetic field? However he does the modulating of one of the magnets, can he be creating harmonics? And I think the answer is no, because, and this, by the way, you're going to see a beautiful article on the subject, which was in the latest issue of QST. I think it was the Doctor's In section, in which Joel, Doctor is In, page 50, August issue, QST magazine, beautiful diagram at the bottom of the page, where Joel Hallis, who I've been doing quite a bit of writing with lately, and you'll be reading something about that in the October issue. He and I have had quite a conversation on an interesting subject, but what I'm getting at is, why do mixers need to be nonlinear? That's the title of Joel Harris's major article, the first question and answer that he gave September, August 2013 in the Doctor is In section of QST. You look at those curves at the bottom of the page, and you read his words on the subject. Let me drop a curve. And Joel will explain to you the difference between a linear amplifier that, if it's truly linear, makes no third-order intermodulation distortion, makes no harmonic energy. And he compares it with the second curve at the bottom of the page. Figure 2 shows you a non-linear curve, and the non-linear curve will do mixing, it'll do harmonic generating, it'll do intermodulation distortion generating, and he gives a fairly nice explanation for it. The reason I say fairly nice, it's got nothing to do with him. It's a fairly complicated subject. Until you learn the meaning of all of those trigonometric identities, which is part of the way you convert a nonlinear waveform into a Fourier series. In other words, you figure out what frequency components are in a waveform because of the mathematics of the nonlinearity that your piece of hardware is experiencing. My point on this one, John, is that a magnetic field in free space, in air, that's even being modulated, is a fairly linear process. Let me drop. However, in some cases, you want to intentionally make something nonlinear. Because a diode has got this characteristic curve where when you forward bias it, it's got a squaler effect, and you reverse bias it, and it's an open circuit. The nonlinear characteristic of a solid-state diode, for instance, is a kind of nonlinearity. Therefore, diodes used the right way make beautiful mixers. I, therefore, in the experiments that your writer is telling you about, in theory, I could put my two magnets on top of some kind of magnetic responding material, maybe a piece of ferrite magnet, maybe a piece of yttrium iron garnet, Yig filter raw material, maybe a piece of mu metal. In theory, I can put my two magnets on some kind of material that has saturation characteristics of the BH curve. And once I force the environment around the magnets to be nonlinear in any way, I am, by definition, generating... Let me drop. I am, by definition, generating harmonics of the frequencies, mixing pluses and minuses of the frequency waveforms, and so on. So there are ways that you can force magnetic nonlinearity. And yes, then it will be a mixer. But air doesn't do that. The nice thing about air is that until you arc it over with high voltage, or until you... magnetic fields will almost not ever saturate air. Obvious by the fact the strongest magnet in the world, I can't think of the name of the organization that's building this darn thing, can create a magnetic field in air that's so potent that it's literally lethal to a human being. You don't want to go near the damn thing. You drop a copper tube through the thing and it takes half an hour to drop through the magnet because of the eddy current effects. So in his experiment in air, no. But if he wants to, there's ways he can make it do mixing if he wants to, John. KC2WGB, KQRI3 in the TechNet.
Okay, well, at least he's got a straight answer. In air, no. He has a little drawing of the two magnets with the north facing approximately at 45 degrees, and they oscillate back and forth about 15 degrees, and he was wondering about, in air, would that create another wave? Okay, very good. I'm sure you And I'm sure if he Googles magnetic fields, he could probably get something close enough to show him. And a lot of them are cartoon-type drawings that are animations, and he may get a further understanding from that. All right, let me drop this and go on to the next one. Okay, I have one here. It's Roy again, same gentleman who sent one last week. I have another one, and it's a pretty good one, which I've never heard of. He wants to know about superconducting antennas, if you know anything about that, how they work, and what they're used from. I didn't know they existed. But over to you, Dick.
Almost every component in our world of electronics can be made superconducting if you're smart enough. I personally have worked on superconducting filters. See, every filter you build has a certain amount of filtering capability. Generally, it's how many poles are in the filter, how sharp are the skirts, what's the 6 dB to 60 dB bandwidth ratio. It's a sharpness of the skirts, insertion loss. If the filter had ideal enough tuning elements that had no loss to them, then in theory you can make a filter that has no insertion loss, very steep skirts, and all kinds of good things can happen. So if your filter is made out of the equivalent of inductors and capacitors, and the inductors, let me drop. In many cases, an inductor is made out of a coil of wire. The wire has resistance, and therefore there's a finite amount of Q you can get out of an inductor capacitor put together as a filter element. That's one of the poles of the filter, or two of the poles of the filter, so to speak. And the magic about quartz is that you don't have to put any wire there. The natural resonance of a piezoelectric effect with inside of a quartz crystal can easily give you a Q of 40,000, as you just measured a few minutes ago, John. And to try to get a Q of 40,000 out of a LC filter is out of the question, unless you make it superconducting. So if you superconduct the coil of wire that's part of the LC network, you can now get a very high Q resonator. And so when it comes to antennas, the motivation to make the antenna higher in Q would be that, and let me backtrack on this one. Every reasonable size antenna you guys and I ever deal with is doing something that's very non-obvious. And that is, I keep stating to you guys something that's not in any good antenna book. I'm amazed by that. It's not told in any courses. And I'm amazed by that. I guess it's because in some cases the professors don't realize it. They give you coded words that almost tell you the truth, and that is, it's a standing wave structure. Well, it's a fancy way of saying you put that valuable radio signal you've generated into that antenna. You would like the signal to go into the antenna and jump into space and be radiated. Absolutely not. Mother Nature didn't make it that simple. That radio signal is going to bounce back and forth in that antenna of yours something like 20 times before it finally gets radiated. 5% of the energy, you could say, is radiated on each bounce. And what you and I call resonance of the antenna means that all of those bounces stay in step with each other. They stay co-phase. And if they're not in step with each other, you don't get a very big signal. You don't get very much radiation. You get a lot of ISRA. It's equivalent to pushing your daughter on the swing, and you do it with the wrong timing, and she doesn't build up a very big deflection on the swing. You're not resonating the system, if you know what I mean. Okay. The antenna itself, because the signal's going to bounce back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated, and if you can make the amount of loss of the antenna on each one of those bounces very small by superconducting it, then yes, you're going to get higher performance out of the antenna. Let me drop. It's radiated on each bounce. And what you and I call resonance of the antenna means that all of those bounces stay in step with each other. They stay co-phase. And if they're not in step with each other, you don't get a very big signal, and you don't get very much radiation. You get a lot of ISRA. It's equivalent to pushing your daughter on the swing, and you do it with the wrong time.
Dick, would it help to make making the antenna a lot smaller? Would it be advantageous to make to make the antenna smaller if you could freeze the antenna?
On each one of those bounces, very small, like superconducting it, then yes, you're going to get higher performance out of the antenna. Let me drop. And the answer is no. Whenever you make an antenna physically small, what really happens, Barry, is that the number of bounces that the signal has to take before it finally gets radiated becomes a much, much larger number. Every physically small antenna, with careful tuning, can be brought into resonance, can radiate 98% of the signal you put into it, and can be fairly efficient. If you make the antenna small, it's going to be very narrow band. That's what high Q means for an antenna that's physically small. KE2EJ, K2RIWF, Eric, you might want to cut off one of the inputs at this time, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
This is NY2, it's got an Echolink station broadcasting. I'll knock him out in a few minutes if he doesn't clean up his act.
Very fine, Lou. One of the things that's very good to know is that the antenna that you start off, like say for instance a dipole, it's a half wavelength long. There's nothing magic about keeping it exactly a half wavelength long. You could, if you want to, take your 80 meter dipole that starts off 132 feet long and shrink it to 100 feet, 80 feet, 60 feet, 40 feet, 30 feet, as long as you re-resonate it electronically. Resonated electronically by putting loading coils and an antenna tuner nearby the antenna and whatever, the infinitesimal dipole, at least at the frequency you properly tuned it, can give you full performance. With finite materials, as you make the antenna smaller and the Q goes higher, that really means the signal is going to bounce a larger number of times. Let me drop. And by the way, Lou, are we about to time out the machine? What do you think, Lou? NY2H, K2LAW.
Okay, I try it now.
Well done, Lou. As you make the antenna smaller, the number of bounces required... Let me backtrack on that one. Remember I'm telling you that the signal has to bounce back and forth 20 times before it finally gets radiated. The length of the antenna is one of the big factors. That's a big secret, by the way. The length of the antenna physically at that wavelength determines what percentage of the signal gets radiated on each bounce. On a full-size half-wave antenna, roughly 5% of the signal gets radiated on each bounce. The signal is going to bounce 20 times before you get most of the signal radiated. You make the antenna physically smaller. Instead of 5% radiated, only 2 or 3% is radiated on each bounce. Therefore, it's going to be a larger number of bounces. Therefore, there's a higher performance requirement in order to keep all those bounces co-phase in resonance. That's part of the explanation for why the antenna becomes more narrow in bandwidth, higher in Q, so to speak. And you could, if you want to, make the antenna superconducting so that the amount of insertion loss of the signal flowing through the antenna on each bounce is smaller. Let me drop. But if you look at the physical rigmarole required to get superconductivity, the particular materials you're using might not go superconducting until you get down to 70 degrees Kelvin, the liquid nitrogen boiling off temperature. That's minus 100 and some odd degrees centigrade. To do that with an antenna that by definition has to be outdoors in the air at a high altitude to work well, and now to make that cryogenically cooled, that's a lot of rigmarole, and I don't recommend it. One of the experiments that I've done, some of the patents that I've filed on antennas, because I did something illogical. You think when you're making a Yagi antenna, for instance, you would like to have the highest possible Q, you think, of each one of your directors and reflectors. Therefore, people think that the Yagi gives you the highest performance if each of the elements are small in diameter. Dead wrong. Let me drop. If you're smart enough to make the directors and reflectors of a Yagi antenna, for instance, out of a very wide piece of sheet metal, and normally you have a 0.05% bandwidth, a 0.05% thickness of the director or reflector rod of a Yagi antenna, And if you decided to make it out of something very wide, either large diameter tubing, or in my case, at a 900 meg antenna, I was making them out of very wide pieces of sheet metal that were being cut to act as the director. All of a sudden, the loss goes very low, even though the Q didn't go higher. And yet you get full performance out of the Yagi, and then some. And you get much broader bandwidth and lower standing wave ratio. So you don't have to go superconducting on the antenna to get high performance, even if you've made it small. Just make the elements wide enough. Recognize what's giving you the loss and make the loss go down by having wider elements where the current is spread out over more copper and therefore there's less loss. Do you see the philosophy on this one, Paul? Barry, who asked that sub-question, and it's a good one. N2 Moon Balance, K2LIW and the Tech Man. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I do. It sounds like if you were building the antenna out of space, you might not need to make it so small that you have lots of space, but it would work because it's very cold out there.
Yeah, I think you're right. Choose the right materials. Make sure the sun is not shining on your antenna. The sun shining on the antenna, depending on its absorptivity to emissivity ratio, A over E index is what the space people call it. Depending on that A over E index and the sun shining on, your antenna might run at 100 degrees Fahrenheit. But as long as you keep the shadow of the sun on the antenna and the antenna sees nothing but the 3 degrees Kelvin, 2.73 degree Kelvin background temperature of free space, yes, your antenna automatically becomes cryogenic. Choose the right materials and it becomes superconducting. Therefore, the antenna is higher in performance. But in general, on Earth, we don't need superconducting antennas. We do need superconducting filters because you want the filter to be small, you want it to have a whole lot of poles, you want it to have very little insertion loss, and you want sharp filters in many cases. However, maintaining the superconductivity on a filter, let me drop, on a warfare machine, in other words, you're designing a surveillance receiver for an airplane that's going to be used as a warplane, and you want high performance, and you choose a superconducting filter, and you get the superconductivity by way of liquid nitrogen you pour into the filter. The liquid nitrogen is continuously boiling off. When it boils off, the filter becomes non-superconducting, the performance goes away, and you know darn well what's going to happen with Murphy's Law. You're going to lose the liquid nitrogen in the filter right in the middle of the heat of battle, and you ain't going to be happy about that. So there's a lot of vulnerability. So in many places, you might not want to use a superconducting filter. But superconducting has got some very nice properties that at times can do some real magic, and it's kind of fun stuff. So I'm trying to remember now, John, what was the original question? Was it a filter? Was it an antenna? Where did we get into superconducting here, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Well, I think you covered it very well, Dick. He was looking for any information you had on superconducting antennas and, you know, how they're used, if they are used, and things like that, which I think good example. And that's a great idea with Barry out in space. Yeah, it's cold, so basically we have superconducting antennas possibly out there. Back to you, Dick.
And it's nice to have that in your hip pocket as a possibility. But most of the time, if you're smart enough as an antenna engineer, I think you do not need it. Even if you're using lossy materials for the antenna, like stainless steel, like you want your antenna to be bendable, you want it to be resilient, you want it to be non-rusting, and you choose to make it out of stainless steel. Stainless steel is a nice, beautiful material to make bolts and sheet metal and whatever out of. However, it's got a resistivity that's a little bit better than nichrome, where you make wire-wound resistors out of it. So, however, you could make a stainless steel antenna, and I once did, and if you make the elements of the antenna wide enough so that the current density in amps per centimeter, so to speak, amps per square centimeter, is lower enough, even a lossy material can be high in performance if you're smart enough to physically design the antenna that way. I am convinced I could make a high-performance antenna out of carbon granules, the stuff that you put into an Allen Bradley resistor. If you allow me to make the elements wide enough so that the current density is low enough so so there's enough parallel paths for the radio signal to flow through, I can give you a high-performance antenna out of carbon granules. It's a matter of recognizing where the loss mechanism is coming from, what physically is happening, what is the mechanism by which radiation takes place. And you guys are getting the secret here, and I'm amazed that the books don't tell you and the courses in the engineering schools don't tell you. It's time for a change. That's an opinion. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QAQ with a comment?
Go right ahead, Glenn. Glenn, the guy who's about to buy a fantastic set of binoculars. You got it, Glenn.
But before I do, I've got a question for you. I made some measurements on a couple of antennas. Way back when, we were talking about a slot antenna. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because this issue of efficiency just came up in an antenna, whether, you know, being superconductor or not. And what I'm wondering is, when I started taking measurements of efficiency, in other words, basically I was putting a signal from a signal generator into an antenna, a whip at half wavelength, and I measured the signal at about 5 wavelengths away with a reception antenna, I noticed that with the slot antenna, I had a little bit higher efficiency. Is that what you would expect, Dick? K2RIW, K2QIQ.
I see what you're asking, Glenn, and there's a large number of variables involved, and sometimes it's very hard to pin down what is really, who's eating your lunch, so to speak. If I had to measure the efficiency of a whip antenna, let's start right there. Logically, because it's radiating, and I want to measure how well it radiates, you think I'm going to measure how strong is the signal it is radiating. Some number of wavelengths downrange, I'm going to measure how strong is the signal coming off the antenna. Good, logical conclusion. I don't do it that way. The reason for that is because at any reasonable frequency, unless you've got the world's best anechoic chamber to do your measurement in, you're getting reflections off the ground, the trees, the buildings, the downspout gutters, all kinds of stuff in the environment. You turn on an antenna, and you're turning on all those reflecting objects in the environment that's going to contaminate your results. There's a much more directive way. Anything that has inefficiency must be obeying or disobeying, so to speak, the law of conservation of energy. The quickest way to get an extremely high accuracy measurement of the efficiency of an antenna is to put 100 watts into it for 10 minutes and find out what gets hot. If it has any kind of real inefficiency, and by the way, standing wave ratio by reflecting a signal is not an inefficiency. Let me drop. I'll tell you why. I'm a member for 30 years of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical Engineers. Antennas and Propagation Society has got a dictionary, and in that dictionary of electronic terms, they define gain. When it comes to gain and efficiency of an antenna, they say it is that property you measure after you remove all the standing wave ratio. You make the antenna a perfect impedance match, then you go and measure the gain of the antenna or its efficiency. So reflection because of standing wave ratio is not part of the efficiency phenomena. So you and I set up the whip antenna, Glenn. We make sure it's a good match to the cable. We put 100 watts into it for 10 minutes, turn up the transmitter, walk over there and touch everything. If it has any inefficiency, something's got to get hot. And you'd be amazed how sensitive that test is. For instance, when I wanted to measure the efficiency of a UHF connector, lots of people were telling me that 432 UHF connectors have half a dB of loss. Pure bull. If it had half a dB of loss, and I put 700 watts into it from a parallel kilowatt amplifier, it's going to burn up. I've done that. I put 700 watts for 10 minutes into a tight bend connector. It gets mildly warm to the touch. Maybe it's dissipating a watt of power out of 700. That's 0.01 dB of insertion loss. So by the same token, that antenna, you put power into it, look at it with